Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. First came the unsettling Ouija board prophecy that Robin Adams would die before her 17th birthday. When a minister was summoned to rid the house of frightening phenomena blamed on the Ouija board, he was taunted and denounced by a neighbor and suspected Satanist. Thus, the die was cast for one of the most bizarre murder cases in Michigan history. In 1976, when Robin vanished without a trace from the village of Caro, police were left without a body, witnesses, or anything remotely resembling a crime scene. The case went cold for 6 years. Then when a rookie state police detective was assigned to reopen the investigation, what followed reads like chapters from a Stephen King novel, right down to the claim that the killer's grandmother was practicing black magic to avenge efforts to bring him to justice. The book that we're featuring this evening is Fruit of the Poisonous Tree, with my special guest, journalist and author, Richard Carson. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Richard Carson.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much. I want to make sure that I'm pronouncing the name. Is it Caro or Cairo?
Caro, like Caro syrup, yes.
There we got it, Caro. Okay, now, one of the questions I typically ask him, how did you come to write this book? Without giving anything away, what was it about this story, or how did you come to write this book, Fruit of the Poisonous Tree?
Well, I should mention, Fruit of the Poisonous Tree is the ebook, which derives from the published version, which was called Murder in the Thumb. And the reason for the title change is we did some editing and tried to make the book a little more presentable to people outside the area of where the crime occurred. How I became interested in it, I had worked for the Small Daily in Huron County, which is the northernmost county in the Thumb of Michigan. I had been there for 15 years. During that time, I'd covered two murder trials. But I left the paper, the Small Daily, in 1981. And we settled in Columbus, Ohio, and I went to work for the Columbus Dispatch. During that time, I was receiving the newspaper that I had left in Michigan, and I became aware that the trial of Melvin Garza, the suspect and eventual accused in Robin's disappearance, was going to be in Huron County, moved from Caro, which is in Tuscola County, to the immediate southwest. So now I'm aware of the trial. I read the coverage. I know that Lee McDowell, the post commander in Caro, who I knew as a high schooler in Bad Axe, Michigan, where the paper was located, he had reopened the investigation. And further, I was a close friend of the circuit judge in Huron County who would hear the case. So I had some connections to the story. The coverage of the trial really piqued my interest. But believe me, I had no idea what lay ahead.
Certainly. Now, we talked about Cairo, Michigan, and so let's describe this. You talk about it being a village, so let's describe where it is in proximity to, say, a more notable, bigger city, and so describe where it is and what type of place really Cairo, Michigan is, and it's in its size. So tell us a little bit more about Cairo, Michigan, okay, before we talk about.
Okay, well, Cairo is a town of under 5,000 population. It's located, don't hold me to specifics here, but I'd say it's about 35 miles due east of Saginaw, okay? Right. Cairo is an agricultural, Tuscola County is an agricultural county, and Cairo, obviously, is the county seat. Cairo, of course, is where Robin was working as a live-in babysitter when she disappeared. And Cairo's stuck to the village. It could easily qualify as a city, but the locals wanted to keep it a village, and I think they wanted to keep the village character of the community. And I think that is why that moved in that direction.
Now tell us about Robin and Danny Adams, and they moved from Bay City to this rural Cairo their step parents are Bill and Millie Timko. So tell us, they're unofficial foster parents, and so tell us about this arrangement and a little bit more about Robin and her brother Danny Adams.
Okay, let's. They were born in Pennsylvania, eventually their mother moved the family to Bay City. I don't know if I. It gets kind of circuitous here. Vera Adams claimed to be a widow and claimed that her husband, the father of Dan and Robin, had drowned in a swimming accident or something. We're certainly not sure about that. Vera ran into Bill Timko in his travels while she was still in Pennsylvania, and they kind of became an item. And the book traces how they met and the times that they traveled around the country, and they worked at county fairs and one thing and another. Usually during that time, Robin and Danny were with relatives. Vera came from a large family. So eventually they moved to Bay City, and Vera was still very much interested in Bill Timko, and Bill by this time had married had settled in Cairo. Bill would visit Vera in Bay City, and he took a liking to Robin and Danny, and took them fishing and camping and one thing and another. And Danny had a real attraction to Bill as a father figure. One of the painful situations that developed was when Bill assured Danny that he was not his father, even though he would have liked to think that he was. So at that point, the kids are in Bay City. Robinson and Danny are in high school. Danny starts pushing to live with Bill and Bill's wife, Millie, and their children in Cairo. And Vera, their mother, resists this at first, but then eventually she gives in, and that they moved to Carroll, and eventually that's where Robin met Melvin Garza, and eventually Danny, which is explained in vivid detail in the book, Danny kind of wore out his welcome with the Timcos, and he ended up, they returned him to his mother, and she shipped him back to his grandparents in Pennsylvania. So that's how the kids got to Carroll, and Robin met Melvin's sister, Nora, who eventually had a role in Robin's disappearance, and we can get into that later. At any rate, she introduced Robin to her brother, and that's when their relationship started.
Now, you start this book and introduce some characters early on that are, of course, very, very important to the entire story and to the end and to the trial and every aspect of the story. So let's talk about Dan Miller, because you introduced Dan Miller early on, and then, of course, he is a central figure in this story as well. And also, you talk about the Robin and her brother and the other family members in the Timcos sitting around and fooling around and having an interest in the occult, Satanism, witchcraft, but it starts off with the Ouija board. So tell us a little bit about the Ouija board experience, because I think it's very important to this story later on.
Well, basically Cheryl, Tyson, was Millie's daughter by a previous marriage, and she was just a little bit younger than Robin, and they became real sisters once the Adams children moved in with the Timcos, and it was Cheryl who suggested that they experiment with the Ouija board, and it started out innocently enough, and I don't want to get too much into the to the paranormal in terms of do I believe these things or not believe them. I leave that up to the readers. But there is no question that problems emanated from the Ouija board experience. Not the least of which was the fact that at one point a entity, I guess is the best word I can use, she identified herself as Glenda, and she was someone that they could communicate with the Ouija board. And in this, I mean, you have two teenage girls here, 15 years old, I think, at the time, or Robin may have been 16. And it was just kind of a gleeful little adventure that they were involving themselves in, but it moved to a dark side, and they began to have hear footsteps on the stairs when no one was there, and strange sounds in the attic that adjoined their bedroom, and the lights flashing on and off, and it just got completely out of hand. And during this extended experience with the Ouija board, the girls asked different things about their future. Cheryl about whether she'd marry and have children, and Robin, for some reason, asked how long she would live. And at that point, the Ouija board predicted that she would die before her 17th birthday, which was ominous. And not totally accurate, because she disappeared 6 weeks before her 18th birthday. So once all these phenomena took place in the house, the girls no longer wanted to stay in their bedroom. They were frightened. So Millie called a local minister, and he came to the house to perform, I guess you'd call it an exorcism of whatever spirits were complicating everyone's life in this house. And when the minister arrived, the neighbor, and the neighbor was a kind of a strange fellow. His name was Aubrey Vincent. He was an artist, a painter and sculptor, and he lived a Spartan life in a one-room cabin that was on property that was right next door to where the Timkos lived. And he was friendly with the kids, and they would sit around a campfire, and there was probably a little bit of pot smoking and beer drinking going on, because he kind of lived out of the way, and he was off the road, so there was an element of privacy there for kids that kids, typically adolescents, really look for that. So when the minister showed up, Aubrey noticed that he sees this man that he doesn't recognize, and he sees that he's holding a Bible. And so he launches a rant and denounces the minister, and it created a confrontation of sorts. But the minister shook it off, and Aubrey eventually stomped off, and that was the end of that. But in my frame of reference, by the time you've gone through these various steps, this story is starting to sound really a little bit strange. And I had seen nothing yet, because there was a lot more down the road that was going to complicate my research and hopefully make the book more compelling and interesting.
Now, you talked about Marvin Garza and Melvin Garza, and you talked about a car accident, and you include this very early on in the book because you feel it's important. So, and people at the time, well, like it, Heather Cade, said that it made a difference. So tell us briefly about the car accident and Melvin before the car accident and afterwards, and why it might have made a difference in his life, this accident.
Okay. Well, what happened? Melvin, incidentally, is a very intelligent and a very skilled person. He had a builder's license when he was 18 years old. The car accident occurred. What happened? A group of boys, Melvin and his classmates, three of his classmates, were involved in a home construction project that was part of their high school experience. And this particular home was not built in Cairo, but in Mayville, which is to the south of Cairo. I think it's about 8 or 9 miles. So they pretty much finished this house, and there was going to be some of the boys volunteered to come and help their teacher clean up the refuse and things that are left after you complete a construction project, to kind of clean up the site. And so the boys were through with classes, and they arranged to go to Mayville and clean up this house, and and really pleased their teacher. And so they did that. Well, one of the boys, and I renamed him in the book for, I think, good reason. One of the boys drove the other three to Mayville, and they did their little project. And they were on the way back, and there was another group of students from Cass City, which is, it would be, let's see, to the northeast of Cairo. And they too had been involved in this construction project, and they were there, and they were in another car. Well, as it happened, the boys kind of the Carroll boys left ahead of the Cassidy boys, but the Cassidy boys caught up with them and pulled alongside and kind of challenged them to a drag race. And that commenced and at a high rate of speed. And eventually, Mike Clark is the driver of the car with the Carroll boys. He sees an approaching car, oncoming car, and he tries to brake and get control of the car because he's going so fast, and he skids into the shoulder, and the car then he loses control. It crosses the center and hits the oncoming car. It wasn't a total head-on. It was more or less one side of one car hitting the side of the other. The woman right. in the car, the older woman, was injured. The driver, Mike Clark, was killed. He died. The boys were all thrown out of the car, and he died right then and there. Melvin suffered a broken collarbone and some other injuries. One of the other boys had a broken leg. Melvin and I talked to many of his friends in forming this impression. They said that he took Mike's death really hard, and that he even went as far in some conversations as to say that he wished it had been him instead of Mike for whatever reason. The people I talked to, his classmates, each and every one said that Melvin's personality seemed to change dramatically after that accident. I did mention the Heather Cates, again a pseudonym, and she injected a bizarre dimension into it, claiming that the young fellow who was killed in the accident was not what he seemed to be. And this notion was rejected by anybody and everybody. So I wasn't sure where that was going, but in as much as Heather Cates, as a high schooler, practiced witchcraft, here we go again. And Heather has an experience later on that we may get into that really justifies her place in the story.
Now, Melvin Garza comes from a big family, and his sister, you had already mentioned it, Nora, had introduced Robin to Melvin. So tell us a little bit more about the Garza family. Mother's Clara. So tell us a little bit more about the family and how close Nora and Melvin are in age.
She was, she had just turned 17, and that's significant. And I don't know how much legal minutia you want to get into here, but Nora had just turned 17 when Robin disappeared. And I guess the belief was Melvin broke into the house where Robin was after Robin graduated from high school. She took a job as a live-in babysitter. And after she broke up with Melvin, a breakup that he violently opposed, he broke in and beat her up. And from that point on, that was a little more, I think, than 2 weeks from the time that she disappeared. The Garza family, there's 9 children. Melvin was the second eldest. His older brother, Augustine, in fact, his older brother, Augustine, was in charge of the family while the parents were in South Texas visiting relatives. at the time that Robin disappeared. Nora, as I said, she had just turned 17, and there was actually a possibility that Robin's disappearance, or ultimately, as we learned, her murder, could have occurred before Nora turned 17, and that would have been significant in terms of the juvenile court jurisdiction and the fact that she might not have been incarcerated, which, again, we'll get into that. Bill Garza was a self-made man. He and Clara started a house, I think it was back in the 50s, and one of these deals where they dug a basement and cement block construction and resided in that and built up the house as they built up the family. And it's a good family. And Bill and Clara are good people, and Clara thought the world of Robin and was completely crushed when the reality of her disappearance came to the fore. Bill and Melvin, were kind of they had some characteristics in common, and I think that. Melvin became an adolescent, typically father and son didn't always see eye to eye. Bill was a typical Mexican American patriarch and ruled the roost and kept order. And with a family that large, you pretty much need a controlling figure. You're going to be consigned to eternal chaos. They were good people. I got to meet them and spend time with them when we visited Melvin in Southern Michigan prison, which is a long, long drive. And so I was with them for many, many hours and got to learn a lot about their family and about them.
Now, you talk about Bill and Millie. Let's go back just a little bit because this is very important. Of course, Melvin Garza is a charming guy, about 5'10", kind of well-built, 160 pounds. For all accounts, pretty sociable guy. Nothing so outwardly weird or creepy about this guy. But at some point, this relationship sours, and Bill and Millie really wanted Robin to stop seeing Melvin.
Yeah.
So there was that dynamic going on there. So you also point to a couple instances like where there was a Cheryl and Robin shared a diary together, and one day that diary was missing. So it just, maybe you could tell us a little bit about that story, which probably indicates quite a bit about Melvin Garza.
I'm glad you brought that up, because if we're able to get into some of these other things, you'll see a pattern. But Melvin was very I don't know the exact perfect word to describe it, but he kept track of people that he knew, and he eavesdropped, and he oftentimes he would be someplace where he could overhear conversations. He even tried once to rewire a phone so he could tap into that, and I think that adventure faltered. But when Robin and Cheryl, as I said, they became almost like real sisters, and Cheryl had a diary, and she invited Robin to share it so that they would both make entries in the diary. And among the entries would be their interest in boys and boys they dated and one thing and another, things that you would not necessarily want a current boyfriend to be reading. And Melvin was aggressive in the way that, and it is characterized in the book where Cheryl and Robin came home from school one day, and Cheryl's parents were working, and Melvin had invited himself into the house and was there waiting for them. So it was clear that he was willing to enter the house when no one was there. So he became the prime suspect when the diary disappeared. And ultimately, the diary was returned. It was mailed mailed back in a package to the rural mailbox without explanation or return address. And he would not admit that it was him that had the diary, but they pretty well believed that that was the case. And this was Melvin's MO. And later on, there's an incident that might be instructive if we can get to it, that dealt with the key witness that really broke the murder case, and how Melvin was keeping tabs on him. So, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. The other thing was that to show his controlling nature in this diary, the girls had probably talked about other boys that they had met, but also about smoking and drinking. So I thought it was ironic that Melvin had a real issue with her smoking cigarettes and drinking alcohol.
Yes. And I've always wondered if that was more just a vehicle for his control of her. I don't think that he did not smoke, to my knowledge, although I know there was an occasion of marijuana use, which I suspect was involved smoking, and that I won't get into that now. But his father had probably was a smoker, and then had a lung disease, and my memory is not perfect on that, but Bill quit smoking and would not let anyone smoke if they were riding with him in his car. So I don't know if that trait passed off to Melvin or not. I know that Melvin did drink, and I'm more inclined than anything to believe that that was just one of the areas where he wanted to exert control over her. And he made a big deal out of that, as you realized when you read the conversation that he had with her mother.
Now he has their relationship deteriorates. They go back and forth like many young people, like many people in love. They go back and forth. I'm going to break up with you, but then they're back together again. But there is an incident where she is assaulted, and this is very important to the story. So tell us about the assault and who witnessed it, and just tell us a little bit about that assault.
This was, of course, they had broken up, and I think she had pretty well decided that it was going to be over. Her close friend, Chris, told me that she thought at least one of the times that Robin went back with Melvin was more out of fear than really wanting to rekindle a relationship. What happened is she was alone with the little boy that she was caring for, a two-year-old, and the boy's mother was at work, and so she was alone in the house. It was during the day, and he came to the house and wanted to talk to her. She didn't want to talk to him. She refused. So he removed a screen off the window, an open window, and climbed in the window, and he beat her up. And he We're talking fists, and we're talking bruises, and black and blue, and something that you can't just explain away. But she did. She was quite upset by it, and I think that I know that after that she told her friend Chris that she thought that he was capable of killing her, and she was fearful that he would. What happened is she tried to keep the beating from her mother, but eventually her mother pried it out of her, and they went to the police and reported the assault, and that gave rise to the intercepted phone conversation. I don't know if you want to get into that, and we can, but
sure. Let's get into that phone call.
Yeah. They had gone to the police, and I think it's significant here. A couple things are significant about this. The enforcement of laws against domestic violence have changed, and they've been strengthened in recent decades. But this was 1976, and typically a prosecutor would become experienced with the kiss and make up period, and a lot of women, wives, girlfriends, initially when they were subject to domestic violence, they would want to prosecute. Then they'd change their mind. And of course, by now there's taxpayer money spent and time wasted, and so the practice at that time was to allow about a 2-week cooling off period or whatever, or a period to see if the heat of passion to prosecute was still there, so that they wouldn't waste the prosecutor's time. That's quite significant because Robin disappeared the night before she was to return to the prosecutor's office and go through with an assault and battery charge. Now, the telephone call was damage control on Melvin's part. So now he's beaten Robin, and her mother's found out about it. She's seen the bruises, and she's angry, and she prevails on Robin to prosecute. Then Melvin, Mrs. Adams comes to Carol with a fellow that she was working for, his little girls, and they take Robin to the county fair. And at that time, Melvin approaches them. He's there somehow, or knew that they were there, figured it out. And he approaches them and wants to kind of talk to Robin. And I believe that he could see that he might be in trouble, and that maybe he could talk his way out of it. Well, Mrs. Adams would have no part of that. And Robin kind of ducked in behind her, and she denounced him and told him to, you know, leave them alone. So the next day, Melvin called her. She was living in Bay City, working with this for this gentleman and caring for his little girls, and she was taking sales calls. He was a traveling salesman, and she would take sales calls, and she would tape record them to ensure absolute accuracy. And so she had a tape recorder hooked up to the phone. And when Melvin called her and he was going to try to justify his having beaten her daughter. She taped the whole conversation, unbeknownst to him. And there was some incidentally, and if I can throw a little plug in here, my my website, dickcarson.net, my website has a link to that entire conversation, and it's kind of scary because he makes a lot of veiled threats during this lengthy phone conversation. That he doesn't know what's going to happen to Robin, and he's afraid something will happen to her, and he's trying to encourage Mrs. Adams to take her back to Bay City. So that that link is on there, as well as a police interrogation of Melvin in the first. The investigation was two phases, and this was the first phase. There's a recording of that, and also a recording of, I mentioned, a key witness, who is Tim Thomas, who was a friend of Nora's, and someone she confessed to, confessed her role in the crime. And it's a recording of Tim Thomas's testimony at a preliminary hearing where the Nora's attorney tries to throw him off but fails miserably. It's quite dramatic, at least in my view. So there you have the phone call, the recorded phone call, which I talked to jurors. Well, I'm getting ahead of the story anyway. The phone call was critical, a piece of evidence. I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay, let's not jump ahead here, and she's moving around a series of safe houses. That's how much she fears this guy, and her family mm-hmm. fears this guy, and other people have intervened, neighbors who have seen that are concerned for her. So, but there's a letter that she receives, going to Canada letter, and we won't get into what happens later, but let's just talk about the letter itself. What is it contained? When does she receive it? Tell us about that.
Okay, I think she received the letter. I think it was the Friday before Sunday night that she disappeared. And it was the going to, it became labeled for investigative purposes, the going to Canada letter, because in the letter, Melvin said that he was going to go to a community, and forgive me, but I'm not remembering. It's in Ontario. It's a small town, and it escapes me at the moment. But at any rate, it was it was a long ways away. I mean, it would be, I think it was 500 miles or something, where it would be a really long drive. And if you were going to go there on a weekend, it would take the whole weekend and then some. And obviously he did not go. And, you know, there's different interpretations of that, but essentially the letter was, Melvin sounded like a whipped puppy. I mean, he was basically telling her how much he loved her and how brokenhearted he was, and how there would never be anyone like her in his life, and that he would go to this a quaint little village in Ontario and spend some time there and try to work through his grief at having lost the love of his life. And it was a very long letter. I'm tending to jump ahead. If we get into the police interrogation that I mentioned is available on the website, it's quite diametrically opposed to what the contents of that letter were.
Okay, now the letter makes her and her friends briefly, and again, we won't jump ahead how she knows this, but what she does is while she's babysitting this two-year-old is that she has this letter from Melvin Garza, who has been terrorizing her for quite a while now. So yeah. With that, she believes that, okay, she believes the essence of the letter in that he is going to be gone for this weekend into crossing the Canadian border into Ontario, so she'll have the weekend to herself. And yes. That's what she thinks and what other people think.
Yeah, her friends said that she dropped her guard. Right. That she dropped her guard and that she was a less vigilant and not looking over her shoulder as much as she had been. And of course, again, we're jumping ahead, but certain people who will be discussed in later in thought that that may have been a ploy. Melvin always said that that he between the time he wrote the letter and made the decision not to go to now this is him talking not to make the trip to Canada, that he found out he was going to have a job that would start on early Monday morning, which would have made the trip impractical because it would have been hard to get back on time for the job. Now that's you can argue that different ways, but that was the story. But she did think initially, and then there was an observation that you're aware of, but she did think initially that he probably meant to go to Canada, would be gone, and that she wouldn't have to be as concerned about something that he might be doing if had he remained in the area.
Now tell us about the incident itself. We're probably not going to be able to cover this entire book because we've covered this with a great amount of care here so far, but tell us how she is discovered, Robin's disappearance is discovered, and who they find in the home, and what evidence, if any, they find at this, what we would find later to be a crime scene. So tell us about the incident itself, who discovers Robin first has disappeared.
Okay, the purse did not disappear. Some of the contents did. Okay, she's babysitting, and the young woman who has worked a shift that ends around midnight, and so Marlene. Marlene Davis was the mother of the little boy, and she's working a shift that ends around midnight. So she comes home, and the house is locked, and she was surprised because typically when she would come home from the shift, Robin would be right there and she'd let her in. So this surprised her. So she came into the house and there was laundry that Robin had been folding laundry when she left to work her shift when Marlene left. And the job was not completed, which immediately caused her to be concerned because that wasn't like Robin. Robin would finish the job and the laundry would be put away and it wouldn't be there. So what's going on here? And then the purse is laying there with part of the contents kind of spilling out of it. So Marlene panics initially because she thinks, well, Robin's not there, so little Billy must not be there either. And so she calls her friend Joan, and kind of the family starts pulling together for Where's Robin? In the meantime, after Marlene talks to her Joan, Joan Sayers is the name, and there's a relationship there. Joan's husband is, I believe, a cousin of Marlene's. At any rate, there's a relationship, a family relationship there. So then Marlene goes into little Billy's room, and he, in fact, is there. But there are some things that don't jibe, because he's in a diaper. The diaper's dry, but his pillow is kind of wet, as though he'd been crying, and he has no t-shirt. Robin would, even in the heat, and they had no air conditioning, and it was extremely hot in that August. Marlene recognized that something was amiss. I mean, the laundry's not finished, and Billy's crying himself to sleep, apparently, and he doesn't have a t-shirt that he normally does. Something's wrong here. And so, of course, they eventually commence a kind of a family group search, which turns up nothing, and eventually they have to contact Robin's mother, and the disappearance begins to play itself out with the police involved.
Now, the police aren't initially interested, but the family definitely knows that she's gone, that she wouldn't have just walked away, that she didn't run away to California. Marlene calls the Garza home around midnight or so, looking mm-hmm. for, or tell us the time that she calls, and she speaks to Nora, and what does Nora say?
As I recall, and it's been a while since I looked at that deal, the specific time frames, I think it was around midnight, it might have been, I'm trying to think, that it seems to me there were two calls. Joan Sayers may have made a call, and then I think maybe Marlene, I'm not exactly sure. I think there were two calls, and I think that Marlene made one of them, and Nora answered at least one of the calls and said that Melvin was, I think she said he was sleeping, and he wouldn't want to come to the phone or something to that effect. But of course, well, again, I don't want to get ahead of the story, but go ahead.
Nora had said that Melvin was sleeping, and what was odd later in retrospect was that she had said that he had been sleeping since 10:30.
Right, exactly. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, yes, because that sounded like a information not asked for.
Sure.
In other words, it sounded like the building of an alibi. And that was Joan. That was Joan Sayers' call, and she found that odd. It, right at the time, you know, why is she telling me, giving me times, you know, he's either sleeping or he's not, or he's either there or he's not. But of what value is it to me to know that he's been home for an hour and a half or so? I didn't ask that. So that was a key point. The time frames, of course, again, jumping ahead, become very significant in this investigation and beyond.
Yes, the other call that you mentioned was, I think you talk about Karen Goodrow called at 4 a.m. and spoke personally with Melvin.
Yeah, and yes, that's right. He said that Karen girl called me in the middle of the night, and I, you know, he was sleeping, and he was going to have to get up early, and you know, he kind of passed that off as annoying or something to that effect. But
now the next day, Melvin comes and speaks to Vera, and Vera's boyfriend at that time, significant other, Bob Cronkite, who's an interesting character too, because how involved he gets in this case almost right away as well. So tell us about that altercation and what Melvin did say and what Vera said. What, tell us about that dynamic the next day.
Yeah, well he came to the house, and this again, you know, his behavior is always kind of patterned. You know, he went to the fair to try to damage control the beating. Then he made the phone call for the same reason. Now he's heard that Robin's missing because that Karen girl called at 4 o'clock in the morning. And now he's going to be the good guy, and he's going to come to the house and tell everybody, find out where Robin is, and just, you know, he doesn't know anything about anything. And of course he met with sharp opposition from Vera and Bob, and they weren't having any of him not knowing anything. And they summoned the village officer, and I think that the village officer took Melvin maybe to the state police post and briefly, and then brought him back, because he was working then, and he was on his lunch hour. So I mean, he knew that they were going to accuse him, and he had already started his defense that he knew nothing and was just earnest enough to show up and find out what was going on.
What was his official story initially in terms of having seen Robin that night in question, which was the Sunday night?
Well, he lied. When the police talked to him initially, he lied and said that he had not seen her that night at all. And then during the interrogation, the one that's on the website, he corrects that, and he says that he saw her around 9:30 or so. And of course, it's a kind of a bizarre explanation, because he claims that he parked his car some blocks away and jogged over there so that his car wouldn't be there, because he knew that he was persona non grata with the family after the beating and everything. And so he didn't want his car being seen there, which, again, my thought on that is that he was fearful that somebody might have seen something, and that he thought he better not stick to the story that he hadn't been there at all.
Right. Now, what was his demeanor, not his demeanor, but how cooperative was he with police in this investigation initially? And I want to ask this other question too, is that, to explain, and you do explain this in your book, that even though a lie detector test is inadmissible at trial, but it is still a valuable tool used by police. So again, tell us a little bit about how integral the lie detector test was in this investigation and to this case and story.
Well, it was, there were two. There were two polygraph examinations, and the first one the operator had a feeling that Melvin knew ways to make sure that the findings would be inconsequential, by bodily movements and breathing patterns and different things. So, but he was all in for submitting to the polygraph, and in fact submitted to the second polygraph, and that was the one where the deception was shown. Then, and I will jump ahead here because it's so closely relevant, his sister tentatively agreed to a polygraph and then balked and would not submit to it because in here was a mistake on her part, certainly, that she didn't want to discuss events between the hours of like 10 p.m. and midnight on the so-called day in question. So in other words, well, if we're not going to talk about the time when we think the crime occurred, what good is this test? So anyway.
Yeah, I was telling. Now tell us about in September. Again, there's about 2 weeks later, Melvin goes to state police with a letter he purports is from Robin and postmarked St. Joseph, Missouri. So tell us about this letter and the contents.
Well, the letter, and of course the St. Joseph, Missouri aspect of it remains a mystery. And it was a clever diversion, whoever arranged it. I have some theories, but nothing I could really talk to. At any rate, the letter was that Robin ran away. And that she ran away because she was brokenhearted over the failure of their relationship, which, of course, doesn't make a lot of sense because her friends and the letter that he wrote clearly point out that it wasn't her brokenheartedness and it wasn't her his decision to break up. It was hers. So none of this made any sense, but the fact that it was mailed from St. Joseph, if you were going to California, that might not be the most direct route, but at least it would comport with some sense of here to there, and it falls in between. So and of course, the letter gave the police and forensics people fits because it was hard to tie the writing to him or anyone that might have been inclined to assist him. The letter is in the ebook. The three-page letter is in there, so it could be read by anyone who would be interested in that.
So this case goes cold. Melvin seems to cooperate. They find nothing in his vehicle really substantial. At that time, we're not talking about advanced DNA, not talking about DNA really at all being a factor. But he seems cooperative, and the case goes cold. And then you introduce a central figure in here, a detective, Dan Miller, who is impressed one day about seeing an officer do something, make an arrest with a Thompson submachine gun, and he wants to become a detective despite his...
He's a small boy, and his family takes a trip they lived in Ubley, which is a small town in the Thumb area in Huron County, the same county where the trial was. And his family takes a trip to Jackson. It happened that there was, I believe, either an escape or a riot or something probably an escape. And so the police had roadblocks. And of course, Dan's a small boy, and here's this officer with this submachine gun, and it just kind of he thought it was kind of neat in a small boy's perception, and that was one of the things that he said later in life moved him in the direction of pursuing a career in law enforcement.
Now he's a novice, and yet they give him this cold case, and he, you know, attaches himself to this. And the first thing that he does is he reviews all of the Sergeant Wallner's investigation. But really, what he has is not very much evidence at all, except a couple cassette tapes of the phone calls and the letters. So tell us about Dan Miller and why this case gets a cry into, gets a cry into him, and he gets so dedicated and involved with this case.
Well, it was, you have to know Dan. He's a very interesting guy. He's very focused. He collects Civil War memorabilia and is quite an authority on Civil War battles and different divisions of the Union Army and Confederate and so on and so forth. Dan is smart and he's cagey. He doesn't tell you more than he wants to. And the advantage he had over Milt Wallner, and Milt tried everything, and at one point, as it's in the book, it looked like he almost was going to succeed. But at any rate, Dan used some unconventional approaches, and he spread himself out and made himself known to people. He was younger than Milt Wallner, so that he was able, from a generational perspective, to relate more to the young people that were parties to this whole situation, and the fact that he made himself known and made himself known to Sean Zimmerman, who was a post-Robin girlfriend of Melvin's, and she delivered his child, a daughter, and she became a link to a person in Caro, another young couple, actually, in Caro, who were friends with Tim Thomas, who lived down near Flint, but visited Caro periodically and had a friendship with Nora. So that's the fact that that Dan, as aggressive as he was, and he left no stone unturned, and all this time he's also looking for the body, and to no avail. But looking for the body and looking for a prosecutor, and I don't know if we'll have time to get into this, but it's interesting. The local prosecutor wouldn't touch the case, and the reason why and how things played out subsequently made him look pretty smart. But anyway, but Dan was an excellent investigator, and he was very careful and low key. Once he got wind of Tim Thomas, ultimately, and as you're aware, he was able to arrange a meeting with Tim and Nora. And of course, I don't know if we've covered that yet, but Nora confessed her role in the crime to Tim, because she, to unburden herself, and that's kind of what broke the case ultimately.
It was interesting. Let's fixate on that a little bit, because this is, again, the most crucial aspect of the story in the end, is Tim Thomas and Nora and this first confession. Now, you talk about the conversation that elicits this confession. She's mad at him. He laughs at her, and then she says some details. So tell us about that actual conversation, because it's interesting how this all comes about.
Okay, well, she was, Nora was, she was a, in Mott Community College in Flint to become a dental assistant. And I think it would be typical going from Cairo to Flint that I mean, it would be not out of the way at all to go through Davison, which is where Tim lived. And Nora really liked Tim. And I don't think that Tim ever had a strong romantic interest in her, but I think they dated and they had fun together. And as I recall, she called him and said that she'd be coming through Davison and she'd like to have lunch with him. And so they met and they had lunch, and Nora normally is outgoing and fun, and she was subdued and just kind of in a troubled state of mind that was immediately obvious to Tim. And so, you know, he was asking her what was wrong, and he was kind of needling her a little bit. And eventually, you know, she said something to the effect of, "What would you say if I told you I was involved in a murder?" And he didn't believe her. He didn't believe her at the time, but then, and I'm getting ahead a little bit, but his friends in Cairo, well, they got wind of this, and they wanted, it was Kim Hergenreiter, wanted, she was married to one of Tim's real good buddies, and she wanted to get Tim to meet with Dan Miller, and Tim wasn't real interested until Kim prevailed on him and said, "Hey, you know, this was not some rumored situation. This young woman disappeared, and everyone believes that she was murdered." And so then, reluctantly, she arranged a meeting with Dan at her house, with her and her husband there, and Tim there, and they got together that way. So that's the continuum of the luncheon, the lunch date in Davison, and how that eventually played out and kind of made things come together.
It's very interesting how he uses and employs, Dan Miller employs, the same kinds of techniques that Melvin Garza would use, manipulating, using inside information against another person, taking one bit of information again and using it and revealing it to the other person to create a sort of chaos and see what comes of it. So he was great at manipulating these various people to eventually get the information he wanted.
Dan always said, "You stick in a pin and see who yells ouch." It was kind of one way that, and of course, you're talking about the two, and I'm going to try to remember the names. There's so many Tanya, gosh, I hope I'm, I just think because I did use the real names.
Let's talk about, let's, because well, we don't have much time, Richard, let's talk about more about the unique aspect of, with Dan Miller breathing down on these people's necks, with eventually him appealing to Tim Thomas's, you know, better nature, his real nature, to be able to cooperate, and in his focus, Dan Miller's focus on Nora being this weak link and the key to solving this case. But like you say, with no body, I mean, the rarity of having a prosecution for murder with no body is very, very rare occurrence. And prosecutors are reluctant to do, to go ahead in prosecutions like this. So tell us about the unique situation that was in Michigan at that time, unique to other states, that allowed for the prosecution and how that prosecution came to be. It was, again, some manipulation. It was some influence in there to be able to get this done.
Well, well, and I can back up just for a second because I hate to be Tanja Fieros and Angie Torres were the two gals, and Dan, Angie knew something about a procedure that Nora had that was very personal, and we'll leave it at that. And Dan learned that from Angie and then used it to unsettle Tanja in an attempt to, you know, create pressure and stress on Nora, because Tanja thought she was probably Nora's best friend and maybe more so than Angie. Okay, now you wanted me to you wanted me to get into how the prosecution developed.
Well, how they were able. I mean, to me, it was a very unique situation that I saw, that when you have a grand jury, to have just one person be a grand juror. So that situation is unique.
Okay. Well, it's close to unique. There may be one other state one other state that has a one man grand jury, and there was. The one-man grand jury was designed to target Nora and to get her to give up her brother. And it didn't work. As it turned out, the prosecutor, who was an assistant attorney general, since, as I earlier mentioned, the local prosecutor didn't want to give her immunity, and they felt that was the only way they were ever going to get anywhere. So Mark Bloomer is a very good prosecutor, left the attorney general and went to work in Jackson County as a chief assistant prosecutor. He's very skilled, and he couldn't get authorization to take the case until one of the state police higher ups got to the attorney general and put pressure on him. So, anyway, the result of the Tanja and Angie situation, Dan did get Nora before the county prosecutor, but he would not give her immunity unless she told him her role, and she wouldn't. So that ended that. Once she went before the judge, and this is part of the reason for the title of the book. Nora was given transactional immunity to testify after she stonewalled and exercised her Fifth Amendment rights to not testify. So at that point, she stonewalled. Even though she had immunity, she stonewalled, and the judge obviously knew she was lying. But the judge made an error, and that was that he was willing to issue a warrant for her arrest in spite of the fact that she'd been given total immunity. And that That was something that I discovered in my research that had never, ever come out. And as a result, they were able to arrest her. Now, if her attorney had been on the ball, he was not the attorney that was representing her at the one-man grand jury, but who represented her subsequently. If he'd have been on the ball and read the transcript of the grand jury, he would have known that she was immunized, and he could have got her out of jail. But I think he kind of took the shortcut version, and he missed that. So they were able to keep her in jail, and of course that creates an enormous pressure over time, and that led her to the point where she took them to the area where the body had been buried.
Right.
So am I getting too far off course, or is that kind of where you wanted to head?
Well, you know, that's where we were going, but what we skipped over was the, and again, we only have about 10 minutes, so what I wanted to talk about was one of the more dramatic things that happens okay. at this trial, and what we've, almost the audience almost forgets, and almost as a reader, we forget about the young boy that Robin was babysitting that evening that was traumatized, now is a much older boy, and he's at this grand jury. So I thought this was one of the most profound things of your book, aspects of your book. Tell us about this Billy Jr., Billy Timko, and
okay,
at
now,
trial.
Now, Billy, now understand, Billy is not the little Billy that Robin was babysitting. Billy was part of the Timko family, and
okay, sir.
He was with her the night that Billy Timko was with Robin the weekend that she disappeared. He was with her, I think it was the night before, and he was in the house with her, and he testified that they saw Melvin's car driving by the house. Therefore, he's not in Ontario. Bracebridge, by the way, was the name of the town in Ontario. Billy gives the they not only did they see Melvin's car, but then they went outside the house. They thought they saw a prowler, and Robin thought that Robin actually said they were. This is a little strange to describe this. There was a separate garage, and the garage doors were open. And of all things, and this is kind of rare for garages in my experience, there was a window on the back wall. They're usually on the sides. And so Robin thought that she saw Melvin looking through the back window of the garage. And then Billy Timko was not able to say that he saw that, but that he did know that someone was back there and had run off. So, in court, that there was a concerted effort by the prosecutor to get Billy to testify that she had said it's Melvin. But anyway, so I don't know if that's exactly what you wanted, but Billy, incidentally, and we haven't touched on near the weirdness in this story, but Tini Garza Augustine, the older brother who was in charge of the family when the parents were away and Robin disappeared, Tini died on the 23rd of February 1993. Billy Timko Jr. died on the 23rd of February in 1994, a year apart. And the book is full of those bizarre coincidences that just seem to me, it's hard to as skeptical as you may want to be, it's hard to pass right. those things off as just happening. Did I cover that well enough for you? Or
I think so. The other thing is that through the dogged effort of Dan Miller, and which you again portray in such a heroic way in this book, and his dogged dedication to this case. And finally, we have the conviction many years later of Melvin Garza for this first degree murder. What was the sentence for, how did the courts dispose of with Nora Garza?
Okay, well, that was another complicated mess, but the deal that caused her to be willing to take them to the area where, and she did not, by the way, actually find the burial site, but as you know, and we all know, a wooded area will change its characteristics significantly over a period of 8 years. So it's understandable that she might not be able to walk right to the spot where they had buried the body. But that was the deal. The deal was to give her a break if she would take them to the area or take them to the body. But they let her off with at least getting them to the area. And ultimately, and I won't go into all the details, but ultimately they found the body. And so therefore she was entitled to some consideration. But again, there was a judge, and Rich Knobloch, I've known Rich since he was 13. Rich, you know, was bound by the law to make certain demands of her in exchange for accepting her plea. So they got into a little bit of a runaround there, and she balked for a while, but eventually she came around and told the judge what he wanted to know. My personal opinion, is that she was not totally truthful, but that only she and her brother would really be the ones to know where she wasn't being truthful in terms of her participation in the actual disappearance and murder.
What's, again, one of the most profound moments in your book, and we'll use this as to wrap up in this next couple minutes, is the that they push her on the stand to say that when Melvin arrives, Robin is in the trunk, she helps him bury the body. But they ask her this question that she does not want to answer, and that is, was the grave pre-dug?
Yes, Mark Bloomer had gone to extraordinary lengths. He had actually brought an archaeologist back to the area and had him re-excavate a like-sized hole that would be the same dimensions as the one from which they recovered the body, so that he determined how long it would take to not only dig the hole, but to, if it had been pre-dug, to bury the body and be visible in the Caro area soon enough to kind of begin to form the basis of an alibi. And it proved he was very gratified that she was willing to finally give that up, because he had dragged this poor guy over 100 miles and put him to work digging this hole. So, but Bill Lovis, the archaeologist, a tremendous guy and a fabulous physical condition, it didn't really bother him that he had to dig another hole. But if I could mention one thing,
sure,
Dan, that I think readers would find very interesting. After Melvin was convicted, Tim Thomas had a series of accidents. They were uncharacteristic. I mean, Tim's a big, husky guy, a hunter, fisherman. You know, he's a man's man. And it wasn't like him to, he cut himself with a chainsaw, and he fell through a glass garage window and nearly bled to death. And so he was, you know, what's happening here? I mean, all of a sudden I'm having all these injuries. Tim was the superintendent of a parts plant in Flint. One of his Workers was a Mexican, and he was very close to this fellow, and the fellow said, I don't think this is just happening. I want you to meet someone. And he took Tim to this medium, and the medium said that Tim Thomas was a victim of black magic that was perpetrated by the killer's paternal grandmother, and her name was Natividad Olivares, and she died in, I believe, I think it was 07 or 08, living in South Texas. She had lived for years in Caro, and she was known to practice what is called brujeria, which is Spanish for black magic. She was a full-blooded Aztec Indian. She was not Mexican, but her husband, or her first husband, who would be Melvin's father's father, had died young, and she'd remarried. So at any rate, there was that aspect, and I knew that Tim Thomas was kind of upright guy that would not be telling me these things, fantasizing anything. These things really happened the way he described them. And whether or not the medium was dead on accurate, I'll never know, but that's what she said.
Yeah, well, I mean, this book, we just really touched on some of the drama, but and really didn't go into the really determined, incredibly determined effort by Dan Miller and other police to be able to, and prosecutors to be able to finally get this Melvin Garza, which it seemed that everybody knew he was guilty from day one, to finally bring him to justice, and also justice for Robin Adams to find out really the truth of what had actually happened that night in August 1976. For those that might want to contact you, could you give your website one more time, please, Richard?
Yeah, it's Dick Carson, D-I-C-K-C-A-R-S-O-N, lowercase, .net, okay? And all pictures of Melvin, pictures of Robin, the links that where you can hear Melvin's conversation with Robin's mother and also his police interrogation, and you can hear Tim Thomas's very exceptional cross-examination where the lawyer did everything in his power to confuse and trip him up and got nowhere. Is there anything else? I don't know what our time frame is here, but enjoyed this.
It's been very good, and I want to thank you very much, Richard, for coming on and talking about Fruit of the Poisonous Tree. It's a fascinating story, and we just touched on a little bit of the incredible aspects of this story. So, again, Fruit of the Poisonous Tree. I want to thank you very much, Richard, and you have yourself a great afternoon.
Okay, thank you so much, Dan. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.